Hey everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have but one lovely sponsor this week, Environments for Humans, who are promoting their new conference. Not new, it's been, this is I think the third or fourth year. It's going to be in Orlando, Florida, 2013.incontrolconference.com. It's going to be fabulous. We'll tell you about that later in the show, but for now, let's kick this off.
Hello, and welcome to a wonderful, wonderful episode of the Shop Talk Show. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Hey, while that theme song was going on, I just had a vision of it being dubstep for some reason. Yeah. I really want somebody to make like a dubstep remix of it. And if somebody does... Sweet. I'll play it. It's the way to get.
That's so, an Chris, offer, people.
What are we doing here? We're just sitting around by ourselves, huh?
Well, it's a week before we're both going to be gone. And as we kind of like, so sometimes we record some of these in advance. That's what we're doing here. Not very far in advance, just 1 week in advance. But at this exact second, me and Dave are probably sitting on the beach in Hawaii, drinking some kind of blue liquid out of a coconut. Yeah, we're going to be at the In Control conference. So you've heard us talking about it. We've stopped talking about it because now it's happening. It's gone. It's past that time. And you'll be listening to that this episode the week that we're there. So sometimes when we record a show in advance, we dig into our question archives, dig out as many of them as we can. We don't do any drama, no question answer, no guest even. It's just me and Dave doing a rapid fire episode.
Yeah.
Where we answer as many questions as we possibly can in one episode. Without further ado, here's one from Zachary Brady.
Hello, Shop Talk. I'm just wondering, what's the best way to host videos behind a paywall? That is to say, your website's got a membership or subscription service, and you want to offer videos only to people who have logged in and paid their fee. I know you guys are advocates of having other people or services host the videos, and so they can sort out the hassle of the different video formats and stuff like that. It's all much easier. I'm just wondering what's the best, easiest, most cost-effective way to host those videos. I've seen a few services around, but what puts me off is that they all tend to be on PayPal or Stripe as payment gateways, which kind of restricts your options if you're selling to an international market. Just wondering what your thoughts are. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
All right. How do you host videos behind a paywall? I'm going to divert this question to the person with videos behind a paywall, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you about how I do it. I mean, I have some backstory-ish to this, too. This is like a startup I was going to do at one point. I was like, it's so hard to do. There's no clear answer to how do you host videos behind a paywall out there. Now, you know, it's been years since I've really dug into this. Maybe there are some new startups kind of doing it now, but there isn't just like a thing that pops instantly to mind where, oh, I have some videos, I want to sell them, this is what I should do. A lot of people kind of roll their own kind of thing. So I can tell you what I do for the CSS Tricks Lodge, and then I can tell you a few other things. So the Lodge at CSS Tricks, just css-tricks.com/lodge, is where I did this big Kickstarter, and I wanted to record all these videos, and I wanted to give access to the Kickstarter people for these videos. So they had already given me money in a way. So all I really needed to do was write some kind of protective login system for it and give those people a login to it and then host videos behind it that theoretically nobody else could watch. But I decided to take it a little bit of a step further in that I'm not even going to – I want to lock down the video truly too. I don't want to just have it like, oh, I'll just put HTML5 video back there. But really, if you viewed source, you could find the URL to where the video is hosted and share it. You know, I wanted to lock it down a little better than that. And I also wanted to have it, people be able to sign up and pay for these videos even if they weren't in Kickstarter. So Kickstarter people got the best deal, but if you still want to sign up now and give me money, you can. So I combined two things. First of all, my site is on WordPress, and WordPress already has a login system and a robust plugin world. So I ended up researching some different membership plugins and ended up going with one called Restrict Content Pro. So that's what I use for being able to set up subscriptions for people. And yes, it does take PayPal or Stripe, but it also has authorized.net and it has a number of different ones. And what I got at the end of this question from Daryl was that it seemed like he was looking for an all-in-one solution, whereas I was kind of looking for different parts that I could combine together, you know? So in this case, I'm using a plugin, I'm using WordPress, and then I'm dealing with the video hosting separately. And at first, I was like, God, I wish I could just put the video on YouTube or something, because it's just so easy, and the player is nice, and yada, yada. I ended up not doing that because YouTube doesn't really offer a way to protect videos, really, to watch just there. So I was like, screw it, I'm going to have to do HTML5 video. And I remember this because Dave was working on some video stuff too, and it was kind of a weird time for HTML5 video. All of a sudden, you know, I didn't quite realize, first of all, how kind of complex hosting HTML5 video still is. And then, like, Firefox released some new version, and it just stopped working. MP4s, didn't it? There was something weird that happened. I was like, I thought this video stuff settled down a little bit, but it hasn't really. It's still a pretty volatile world. Anyway, I really kind of I outputted 150 some of these videos, got them in the format, and I was like, crap, I need another format, and had to go through and get all that. And then I was like, oh, but I forgot to do this one kind of special setting that prepares these videos for streaming. And I was like, this is getting crazy, crazy. And it's like, oh, it's not working on this one kind of weird Android device at all. And I'm like, oh, my God. I hate dealing with HTML5 video, and it's not as easy as just like, oh, isn't HTML5 cool? You can just hook up sources, and it just works. No, it doesn't work, and styling it is still a little difficult. You know, the UI that you get for videos isn't that great compared to other things. Anyway.
Yeah.
I have WordPress. I have Restrict Content Pro. I hooked it up to my PayPal account. I'm selling subscriptions perfectly fine. And what I did to protect the HTML5 video, by the way, was just throw the videos on Amazon S3. And then there's a trivial little bit of PHP that I was using that just like generated a really limited access URL to those. So as soon as the page loads, it would load one of these limited access URLs, and I would host it through. So that solved the protection problem. So if they shared it with their friends, it wouldn't work. You know, it was only available for like 60 seconds, and it would keep the stream open, but it wouldn't. You couldn't start a new stream with that URL. So that was actually the easy part. But I hated dealing with HTML5 video. Sorry, this answer is going on forever. I found out...
You're exactly right. It's like, it's way more complicated than you'd think, like, for video. So, like, find somebody to host stuff. But that's my opinion.
Find someone to deal with video for you, absolutely. That's why the startup is still a good idea, I think, if somebody wants to get into it. Turns out, I talked to the guys from Kicktastic. They feel pretty strongly about... They're like, dude, just use Vimeo. I'm like, what? How do you just use Vimeo, you know? It turns out they do have... If you go... They have two different levels where you can pay them, pro and something else.
And business, I think, is the other one.
Something, yeah.
I'll look.
Yeah, you look. There's one where you pay them like a few bucks a month, like 60 bucks a year or something. And there's one where you pay them like 200 bucks a year or something like that. It's not that much more. But what you get at the highest level is this ability to lock down where these videos can be viewed. You can turn them off of Vimeo.com if you want. So they just don't show up on Vimeo. You can only embed them elsewhere. So that helps. But at the highest level, you can say, only allow this video to be played on CSSTricks.com. So that's what I did. And I just uploaded them all to Vimeo. And what that gives you is they deal with all that, like, make sure this video absolutely plays on every possible device. They give you a nice familiar looking player. The player, you know, has good UI, UX, whatever. So that's all I did. You know, I customized the player just a little bit because they let you do that. Remove all the like stuff from it, like related videos and title and all that stuff. So it's just a box that shows the video and a play button, and that's all you get. And it's, you know, you can do nothing with it. You can log into CSS Tricks and watch it, and that's it. You can't take it with you. You can't do any of that stuff. So it's the perfect player. It's the perfect login solution. It's easy. You know, I wrote very, very little custom code to get this done. Works everywhere. It's just exactly what I wanted to do. So that is what I recommend.
I recommend the same thing. If you get... I hung out with the guys at Vimeo once at a South By, and they are excellent people. I trust them with my video, yeah. And just knowing the headaches like firsthand, like it's awful, man. Don't do it. So you think, yeah, I'm just going to put it up on this, and then surprise, it doesn't work, or surprise, a browser changes their mind, or so Vimeo and their team, they're better equipped to deal with all these like nuances and crap outs and all that. So I'm looking at vimeo.com/business, and this may be what you're doing, but and this is like a free ad for them, but they're just saying like other guys, and I was gonna like talk about like Bright Cove, they do this, Wistia, Vidler does this. Those dudes are like 3 or 4 to 10 times more expensive. So I'm starting to just think, dude, yeah. Choose Vimeo.
It's the same as Pro. It's interesting they brand it both ways. It's Vimeo Plus is $60 a year, and Vimeo Pro is the $200. But /business, it just must be a landing page for them.
Probably same deal.
The same thing as Pro. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's pretty good. And so actually, I wanted you to be able to download the videos too. So I actually kept the videos on S3 also and do the little secret linky thing. But you can actually host them straight from Vimeo too. They give you the direct URLs, which they don't at the lower plans. Wow. So I could actually have them download them straight from Vimeo too, because my plan for S3 has been like $500 a month or something. Ooh. Like too much, because people are downloading these big old videos. Yeah. So I might just offload it to Vimeo.
There you go, man.
They sell bandwidth on the cheap.
Cool. Awesome. Well, there you go. Hopefully that answered your question there. So I'll do this. All right. Come on, soundboard. Be with me. Stay with me, buddy. All right. The next question is from Zolt Pence, and writing in, I'm not really surprised when HTML CSS codes differ in different browsers because of all the different rendering engines, but I cannot understand how PHP codes can differ because, you know, those run in the back end. So unless I include like a user agent string in my code, there should be no difference at all. So my question is, how is it possible that browser-specific PHP code exists, and what might be some examples of them?
It doesn't, right? Right.
So, Zolt, like PHP, it stands for pre-hypertext processor. So its job is to run before HTML and then output HTML. So that's, and the browser just reads HTML. That's all it's doing. So I can't imagine a single scenario where the PHP you're using would differ. Can you, Chris?
No, it's not. Maybe you're just confused in that PHP makes HTML, and HTML is what is you're looking at in the browser, and that's probably what's different cross-browser. Just because it's made from PHP doesn't mean that's solving your cross-browser issues, unless you're talking about something else. If you're like, no, $i3+3 echo i, and it's output 7 in another browser, you're on another plane of existence. You know, like that's PHP that it runs on one computer, one server. Doesn't matter which browser is asking for that page. You're going to get the same answer no matter what, because it all is coming from the same computer. So, there's just some confusion going on here. Something else is happening. And that's it. But yeah, there's no cross browser problems with back end code. So next.
All right, I feel good with that one. All right, next question. James Hollingsworth writes in, says, as top developers, That's me and you, Chris. Hey, what are your top tips and attributes you'd like to see when working with web designers? Chris, you're a developer. What do you want to see in a designer you're working with?
Sure. This is kind of presupposing that structure, right? That there's developers and you work with designers, and there's like some designers give you stuff as developers and you make it, kind of. That's kind of presupposing that flow, which is fine. I'm not in that position all that often, but I'd say that if I was in that position and there was a designer and he was handing me off some comp or something, I would just want them to be good. You know, I'd want that file to be a good looking file. I'd want to be impressed with their work. You know, they better be a better designer than I am, because that's your whole job.
That's good.
I don't know. You know, I just, what is the expected answer for this question? What would smart people say?
I don't know. A web designer, like, if you're designing websites, like, you should know, how code works. I would assume you'd know code to some degree. And if you don't know code, I'd assume you'd know how to, like, lay out your PSD in a very sensible manner that makes it look like code, you know? I think for me, if you're designing for the web and you don't totally understand like responsive and stuff, that would be a problem for me. Like if you don't understand like, well, a pixel isn't a pixel and this is going to smush at some point, like that would be a problem for me. So I'd like you to understand responsive. Mm-hmm. I've got a pretty good list going here. I think that's...
I do. I feel like I would say that too. Like it would be nice if you understood the possibilities of code so that you didn't hand me stuff that was so crazy that it would be possible. But I feel bummed out saying that, because I feel like it's dangerous. If you learn a little bit about code and you don't get really good at it and you're just like, well, I guess this is going to limit what I can do in Photoshop because all I know is how to make a div with the box shadow on it, that's a bummer. And I feel like that's why I like working in Photoshop sometimes, is because I abandon that concept of simplicity or whatever, and I'll take challenges, and yeah, I sometimes want to get something from a designer I think that like would really challenge what's possible on the web and use my fancy CSS skills to see if I can pull it off. And if I can't, then go back to the designer and be like, listen, this is too crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But that bums me out that somebody might leave the show and be like, well, I guess I better learn a little code and then learn a little bit of HTML, CSS, and then have that like stifle their Photoshop creativity because they think that code can only do is really limited in what it can do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, like if you, James, are interpreting, hey, I think you should learn code, and then you're like, okay, and you download Twitter Bootstrap and you learn everything about Bootstrap. Well, Bootstrap is cool, but like, I mean, you kind of stop being like experimental at that point, you know? you're like 960, you know, very Bootstrappy from then on. So, gosh, I think always be creative, but I think knowing some code, or for me, Web Inspector makes a big difference, you know, being able to like poke around in code and change and alter. And so like you could come back to me and you're not like sending me PSDs with like red
lines.
There's
no excuse for being totally clueless about where this stuff ends up. So like, being informed is a good idea.
Yeah. Like you can crack open Web Inspector and like now you can like straight up save versions of CSS files and stuff like that, which is like amazing. But yeah, you can just like, I don't know, you're just like, dude, I changed that to like 5 M's and it like fits much better to my vision. And I would be like, sure, 5, I don't care. You know, like, but when you're like, here, I made you a PSD that has like, you know, a red line with a red line and you're supposed to measure it, open up Photoshop and measure it, then I'm not doing it. So like, I guess if you can communicate in the developer spirit, that would be that'd be my tips. But I would assume you could if you're calling yourself a web designer. That's where it gets weird, right? if you're calling yourself a web designer, I assume you have web skills. But if you're, if you don't, you're just a designer. You're just a plain designer. an unemployed print designer. But no, I'm just kidding. I'm terrible. All right, go ahead.
Yeah. That's good. Okay. Let's look it. Let me tell you about Environments for Humans. If you've ever heard a Shop Talk show, you know about them because they've been our longtime fabulous sponsor. Environmentsforhumans.com is kind of their home base for all their conferences. But I want to tell you about one. They're kind of known for doing these summits, the online summits, which are like affordably priced and you can do them from anywhere and they get some of the biggest names to do it. They're really nice, but they also do in-person conferences. And that's what I'm going to tell you about here. They have one coming up in February 17th through 19th in Orlando, Florida, which is probably cold where you live, but it's very nice in Orlando at this time. Believe me, I used to live in Florida, and you know, it's just nice in Florida. 2013.incontrolconference.com. Me and Dave will be there. Mm-hmm. Megan Fisher will be there. Tons of great speakers. It's going to be fabulous. It's one of my favorite conferences, if not my favorite conference of the year. I really like In Control. It's one of those nice ones where the hotel is the same as the venue. So you can just be like, as soon as they're done, you just hop in the elevator and, like, you know, charge your laptop and watch a little Vampire Diaries and then just casually take the elevator back down. I remember the hotel. You can, like, see, like, the hotel's glass and you look at the inside of the hotel as you're descending in the elevator. So you, like, look at it. You can, like, scout out who you're going to talk to on the way down. Uh-huh. That's how it works. It's just a really nice. I like In Control. It's one of my favorites of the year. And it's coming to Orlando, February 17th through 19th. You can use the coupon code SHOPTALKSHOW for $100 off. And it's the early bird pricing right now. So now is the time to come to Orlando. Except me and Dave, we're both going to be there. Funsville.
Awesome. Yep, you should go. Let's get back to the old
Q&A rapid fire. This one's from Zachary Brady. It's an audio question, our favorite kind.
Hey, Shop Talk Show, guys. I love your show so much. My name's Zach. I'm a front-end web developer from Westchester. I have a question about target equals blink because of a conversation I got in with a client of mine. Basically, I always use target equals blank for outgoing links. I kind of view it as like opening the door. I'm giving them a new tab or window so that they don't have to navigate away from my site in case they want to come back easily. My client seems to think, though, that this has a negative effect on SEO, and I've never heard of this before. I just did some quick Google searches, and there seems to be no decision one way or another. What do you think on this subject? Also, these articles I'm finding tend to say it's bad for user interface and experience. Well, I tend to think the other. What's your opinion on the matter? Again, thank you so much, and have a great one.
Awesome. Thanks, Zach. So, target equals blank.
Yeah, what's your theory? Blank. When do you use it, and when do you not use it in your day-to-day HTML? And
yeah, that's a good question. I mean, so, geez. So, well, I want to address, like, his first question, like, is it bad for user experience? And I would say possibly yes. I would lean more on the yes to that because basically you're hijacking the user's behavior. You know, instead of, like, me deciding to open it in a new tab, you're like, meh, I'm opening it in a new tab. And you got to remember, like, back in the day, pop-ups were bad. Like, pop-ups showed up everywhere. They just pop, 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 pop. Like, everything popped up, you know. Since, like, the early 2000s, things have kind of gotten locked down, right? So it's a little better now. We all have pop-up blockers installed, and even, like, Chrome ships with the default one, right? So in that sense, like, yeah, pop-ups were bad because they just kind of hijacked your experience. That said, for me, I'll use target equals blank occasionally when it seems like fitting, like when I'm going to bounce somebody out to another website. For example, if I have like a Twitter link, you know, in the footer of my website or something like that. I'll maybe just like bounce somebody out to Twitter with the target equals blank, because like chances are, you know, like they're going to have a better experience like in a whole other instance, you know, like if I'm going to lose them to Twitter, like in like everything that Twitter is, like kind of like it's like spastic, you know, OCD or whatever, ADHD. So like, yeah, I don't want them to like bounce from my site to there. I want them, you know, to maybe open that in a tab or something in a separate window. But that's I think how I approach it is, does the target site have relevant information? If it does, I'll keep it. But if it's like a totally separate, you know, kind of tower, then I'll target blank them. This isn't my unscientific review, but yeah.
That's good. There's some good thinking there. So, Zachary, you also mentioned SEO. Does it affect SEO? I'm just going to go ahead and promise you that it doesn't. It doesn't. It just has no effect either way. And I always disclaimer that stuff because I don't work for Google and all that stuff. But if it does, I'm going to move to Canada.
Because in Canada, SEO works different, eh?
This is how I would think of it. I would err on never using it and only use it sparingly when the situation really clearly calls for it. So error on no, and it does. And I would even disagree with Dave in that if I had a Twitter link at the bottom of CSS Tricks or something, I don't care. I don't think I would target blank those. But there is cases... Twitter. I just did a search through the CodePen, you know, I just opened all of CodePen, which is where I write most of my code these days, day to day, and did a find and project for target equals blank. And we have maybe, oh, I don't know, five or six places where it makes sense. For example, you're writing a CodePen and you open up the settings area to change a setting. And let's say you open up the CSS settings and you can choose which CSS reset kind of thing you want. And there's a little question mark. So if you're like, normalize, reset, or nothing. For normalize, what if you don't know the difference between those? We put a little question mark in there so you can click it and it'll take you out to learn more information about what those resets are. You're in the middle of trying to choose a setting and write code. The last thing I want to do is close that window on you. So those have target equals blank because we want to make sure that we maintain the state of that page there. Likewise, if you open up the sharing panel to share your code pen on Twitter, that's a new window. Because like, what if your code pen is unsaved? You know, you're going to get this pop-up window warning you about its unsavedness and all that. It's going to be very awkward. Whereas we get to circumvent all that if we just target equals blank those links. So those are very clear-cut UI decisions. If it's a link in content to take them somewhere else, just a hyperlink to some other content or some other page, error on not using it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's all I got.
That's pretty good. I think that's about I was just pulling up an article. Somebody mentions, like, your site won't validate, so that's bad.
Well, no, that's not true anymore.
There you go.
Okay. Not true in HTML5.
And then somebody was saying, yeah, these posts are all old. I think we have a serious – side note. We have a serious problem with blogs. Like most blogging happened in 2007, like pre-Twitter. And since then, there's no like actual truth content anymore. Anyway, that's a totally different subject. But I don't know. This one's also saying like Google Analytics becomes worthless because
– we should make a browser plugin for Chrome that like finds the pub date. It like does some intelligent parsing of the page and tries to find out how old it is. And if it's old, it gets kind of like faded, and then like it uses lettering JS and like every like 10th letter like falls down a little bit and rotates. Like it's just kind of getting old and getting decrepit. So, you know, if you're looking at old stuff, cause it's like harder to read.
Yeah.
The page gets a little yellow.
Yeah. Like you could do like a WebKit mask and like do grunge.
Yeah, crunch it up, but then do like pointer events none, so you can click right through it.
Yeah, dude, that's good. Ah, we got it. Awesome. Cool. I think we nailed it. I'm going to get some juice in this soundboard here. Next question.
Ernesto Chavez asks, my question is about responsive design. I read somewhere it is better to design your breakpoints based on when things start to not look good instead of using known breakpoints such as 320, 480, et cetera, et cetera. Is this a good practice? Have you heard people say this? I feel like I've heard it a lot. It's the squish it till it breaks, squish it till it breaks, squish it till it breaks, rather than using iPad, iPhone, Android.
Yeah, no, I am a subscriber to this theory. I feel like if you're designing for popular devices, you're going to regret it in 1 year, 2 year when iPad changes its dimensions, you know? Case in point, not too many people made sites that were 480 pixels wide. That was a little weird. But, you know, the next iPhone is 500 and whatever, 56 or something, 586 or something weird. You got to be careful about making assumptions that device sizes will always be the same. So that's where this kind of thought comes in, Ernesto. Like, you kind of start with the smallest. I'm, again, on a mobile first trip here, but you start with the smallest and then you just kind of like build out, and then as your content stretches, if it looks weird, then you fire a media query and you make it look better. You know, and this can, you know, you want to kind of like do things systematically. Like, you don't want 9,000 different media queries, although that would probably be fine. But you just kind of want like to figure out how your content and your font size and everything, how that's going to kind of, at what point does that break down? And the way I say it is add breakpoints when things get weird. So you're just stretching and
Man, what is your little thing? Don't you have a bookmarklet like Fit Weird?
Fit Weird. Yeah. I made a little bookmarklet. It's on my GitHub if you're interested, but, you just trigger it and it'll like kind of tell you when things are starting to look weird. So yeah, that, I feel like that's
like that.
Kind of the, you just sort of just vibe it and it starts looking too awkward and too strange.
Doesn't that feel good? Doesn't that like what, like, doesn't it, I like, just try that. Ernesto.
Yeah.
Like, it just is like a good way to work, you know,
because
why pick these arbitrary breakpoints? Doesn't it feels arbitrary? Not only is it not going to be true in a year, cause there's going to be, and already the landscape is so diversified. Although, you know what? I talked to Paul yesterday, Paul Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got some secret stuff, and he wouldn't even tell me about it. Yeah, right. It was pretty interesting. Oh, God, I wonder. I better shut up, actually. But point is, the data around what mobile viewport sizes are is there's a lot of points on that map, but they're not as random as people make it out to be. You know.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Android device that's 491 pixels wide. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that random. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
That's all I have to say about that.
Well, that's true. I mean, like, there are stats where, like, you look at who's browsing the web with what device, and it's iPhone. Like, iOS is always the top web browser for like online shopping, for everything. So in that way, it is probably the benchmark. The key, the key component is probably 320 pixels wide. But, you know, this last holiday season, I mean, there were tons, millions of Kindle Fire sold, and that's like 600 pixels wide. It's so weird. Like, maybe you need to consider Kindle Fire now, you know? So, yeah. The more agnostic you can be about these super breakpoints, let's call them, the better. And just try to make your site look the best on everything, like at all, any random viewpoint. So, yeah, that's all I got, Chris. You done?
That's fine. I'm done.
Okay, next question. It's from Chad Smith. Here we go.
Hey, Shop Talk. I love your show. I'm a longtime listener, but this is my first time calling in and asking a question. I specifically have a question about the homepage of Polygon.com. It's a really well-designed and modern responsive website. There's a div there labeled Meta, and they've used it as a lead-in to their articles. The first paragraph or so of the article is included below, an image and a title that's also related to that article. They've introduced a cool little visual element there. The bottom of the intro paragraph begins a smooth fade into transparency. That is, the actual text fades into the background, and it doesn't look like they've layered a div on top or anything like that. I love this effect because it entices the viewer to continue on with the article. But how do I replicate it? Thanks.
There you go. So, Polygon.com, they have this awesome responsive website. This is a really amazing, like, rich content.
It's basically the best website in the world. Oh, look, another Navicon, the hamburger icon. Yeah, first of all, it's an awesome design. Second of all, it's a good website. Like, I went and checked this out, and I was like, and I ended up reading like three articles. It's a video game site that's super well done.
So they have these on their little like article snippets, you know, excerpts. You know, we've all coded these up at some point in our lives, right? Just a little like brick of article, but you know, sometimes your articles like are 100 words long, and sometimes they're 1,000,000 words long. So you kind of want to like fade clip it, and that's what they did. They like specify, it looks like they specified a height of every box, and they just have a little gradual fade happening at the bottom of the article. Chris, do you know how they did it?
Oh, the fade?
Yeah.
I just like looking at this website. I get distracted because it's so awesome. It's so well done. I really like how when it gets small, at the very top, there's like these features, but they didn't do anything fancy. They just let it be too wide, and then it just gets a scroll bar, and you can just scroll over. I like not overthinking problems like that. You know, like, that's fine. That's totally fine. It will swipe over on phones just fine. You don't need to write 100 lines of JavaScript to click to slide the next one over. And it's a freaking overflow X scroll. Anyway.
No, this is it's amazing. You got to go polygon.com right now. It's every like it's rich, I guess, is the best way to say it. It's like big old images, super like. Yeah. So anyway, this text will like fade out into the background.
Yeah, the fade out is what he's asking. This is interesting to me because the first article that ever got popular ever on CSS Tricks was this exact technique.
Hello. You're the right guy.
Yeah. And I'll point out some ways at which they're screwing it up, I guess. So back in the day, what I did was I went into Photoshop and I made like a 1 pixel wide but 30 pixel tall graphic, and I just did a white to nothing fade, white to transparent fade, and then absolutely positioned a div at the bottom of the text and had it, you know, repeat Y across the bottom. And it would just, that image would lay over the text. And, you know, it wouldn't have to be white. It would just be whatever the background color is. So this only works on solid color background.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it would just lay over. It looks like that's essentially what they're doing here. Meta, let's see. There's like a pseudo element on it or something. And instead of, you wouldn't have to use a graphic these days. You would just use, you know, a color to transparent gradient. Mm-hmm. I bet is what they're doing.
Yeah, it looks like there. I can't. So you know how you can't debug before and after elements really easy because they're officially not on the DOM, so you can't like web inspect them. In my professional opinion, I think what they're doing is they're doing like an overflow hidden on that div meta that's kind of showing the preview, and then what they're doing is they're absolute positioning a after element. So yeah, I see they hit position.
I'm sure that's what it is.
They did position relative, right? And they specified a height and they said overflow hidden. Why would they do position relative? Because you're going to need that to do position absolute. Boom. Myth on busted.
Pseudo. Yep. I just can't actually find it.
No, that's...
It's got to be in here though. Are you seeing... They're doing some weird stuff here. Number one, they're on the Hoffler, Farron, Jones pre-release program. So they're using Gotham here, which is super hot. But then they, like, if you target a paragraph element, there's stuff in here that doesn't exist. The font size, percent, parentheses, 16 pixels divided by 18 pixels, parentheses.
Hmm.
Like, guys.
Like calc?
Looks like some of your less got, yeah, but it's not, that's not a thing. It looks like a mix-in that went awry or something. Like, that shouldn't be in your CSS, guys. Not a big deal. It's falling back to the font size on the parent element, which is set in pixels, which is weird. Okay. It's probably a pseudo element. It's absolutely positioned. That goes from a color to transparent, and it's positioned at the bottom. What they should have done on that pseudo element, which I still freaking can't find for some reason, is put pointer events none, just like we were talking about with the grunge thing. Right now, you like try to select that block of text. Yeah, it doesn't let you.
It lets you to a point.
Which is obnoxious. Obnoxious. Yeah. And if there's a link there, you wouldn't be able to click it, which is beyond obnoxious and just bad UX. Maybe they never have links there, so it's not a big deal. But you know what I'm saying. It's an easy thing to do. It doesn't work in every single browser, but it works in most. Just put pointer events nonce on that pseudo element, and it would have been absolutely a better way to do it. Or what if we had nth last line? Then instead of, you know, like this is nice because it's a gradient, but you could fake a gradient by like making the nth last line one be like opacity 0.2 and nth last line two be like opacity 0.3 or whatever, you know, and make it look like it's fading out, but you wouldn't have to use any overlay. Mm-hmm. That would be cool. Can't do that because it doesn't exist.
It would be cool. Opera. No. Opera's my new scapegoat.
We should have a t-shirt that says comma opera.
Thanks, opera. Thanks, opera is the new thanks, Obama. It's just,
no, some very cool people work at opera.
My CSS doesn't work. Thanks, opera. All right. I think we're done. Hopefully that solved the mystery of polygon.com. Here we are, sleuth busters here. All right. Next question is from Philip Jackson, probably the ex-coach of the Lakers. Is that right? Here we go. So since watching screencast number 113 on CSS tricks, I have used icon fonts a few times, but I am running into issues where sometimes they do not show up in my project from time to time. I mainly use Chrome, so I noticed this with browsers. I noticed this with browsers more than others. But there are times that they do not show up in Chrome, and after opening the project in Firefox, they appear. I also noticed this on other sites as well. So thank God it's not just my projects. It does seem to matter which element you wrap the font or if you use a class or not. It's weird that Chrome, it's a weird Chrome issue. Have you guys noticed this? Ooh, hopefully
icon fonts, they don't show up. There's nothing special about an icon font. So, you know what I mean? It's just a font, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're having this problem, it's not because it's an icon font. It's something's wrong with at font face.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's particularly weird that it doesn't show up in Chrome, but it does in Firefox. I feel like usually that is the other way around because Firefox is a little more strict about what they show. They have that cross origin thingy where they, if you link up, like if all of a sudden your site starts using a CDN or something and it's linking to like cdn.yoursite.com, your at font face fonts will stop working because Firefox doesn't like it when at font face fonts are in a different domain, unless you do some fancy workaroundy stuff in enabling cores or whatever that is, or cross origin something, and specifically tell in the headers of the font files that it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it. Have you ever seen it appear in Firefox, but not Chrome?
No, I haven't. I'm trying to just think of like different solutions or reasons that would happen. The only thing I could come up with is maybe you're using like content, like before and after, and using content. And I don't know why it would work, but maybe you're using the wrong kind of Unicode address in that content. So it's usually like slash E number or something like that. But maybe you're like, oh, I'm going to write and, you know, pound FRT.
Yeah. And you think Chrome is being cool about it.
Yeah. Or Chrome's just like, dude, you can't do that. I'm done. I don't do that. And maybe Firefox is, but that's weird too.
Well, then like throw your CSS through CSS lint or whatever and see if there's a mistake. Mm-hmm. And make sure that you go to CSS3 please and grab the latest and greatest at font face syntax. Make sure that, you know, because that stuff is, man, well, that was volatile for a while, wasn't it? Like, yeah. What's the best at font face thing? Or go to Font Squirrel and just grab a random font and see how they do it, because that's always kind of the latest and greatest. It was Font Spring, I think. They had a blog that they were like doing the latest, greatest research on that for while. So that could be a problem too. If you're not using the greatest, newest, bestest syntax for at font face, that can cause trouble too. And it's so weird. You have to use like URL parameters to trick IE and stuff. It's some wacky stuff. You've seen it. You know what I'm talking about, yeah, right?
Totally. And also, if you're using Chrome Beta or Chrome Canary, it's just called Canary. I would take like font rendering errors with a grain of salt because boy howdy has it had problems historically. So it just for some reason they just something gets pushed through and it just munges up fonts and it just completely breaks how they're working. I feel like we had that problem on Shop Talk Show where we had like inline block and then all of a sudden or something, and it just quit working on Shop Talk or something. But I can't really remember the exact scenario. And we had to just say, oh, well, that's a block element, not just an element with no width or something like that. So, That solves your problem, Philip Jackson. Thank you for writing in.
Dmitry Pashkevich.
Okay, this is an audio question. All right, I think is this the fourth audio question? Then yes, I got it right here. Here we go.
Hey guys, this is Dmitry. I'm a web developer from Russia. I love your show. I have a question about Prototype.js. Basically, why does it still exist? Why is it still maintained? I thought that the developers kind of moved on with it. Why would I want to use it in my project? Thank you.
Ah,
I think this is kind of funny.
Ye olde prototype.
Why does it even exist anymore?
Yeah, no,
that is a good question.
I actually know the like last remaining maintainer of Prototype. His name is Andrew DuPont. He's a really awesome guy. More or less, Prototype is not under development. It is maintained because like serious Rails applications like Rails 1 and Rails 2 got built on it. So it's kind of still a big deal, but Thomas Fuchs, he's like out, I think, or his name is maybe still on the project, but I think he's like out. But yeah, I think more or less it's not doing much, and kind of for the same reason that jQuery, you know, Prototype and jQuery were like competitors back in the day. And more or less, they solved the problems they went out to solve, like cross-browser compatibility. Done, you know? Like, in the time...
Just normalizing DOM stuff, AJAX helpers, and some like array helpers and stuff.
And in the like...
Pretty much.
5 to 10 years that these things have been in existence, they finally... You know, browsers have caught up and said, oh, yeah, it is a good idea if we all don't do something different. So, so their utility becomes way less. But
yeah, there's nothing that, and please, I would like to get trolled on this if possible. There's nothing that Prototype can do that jQuery can't do and probably better. I'll just say that. That's just the way it is. So, don't use Prototype. It's nice that it is maintained. I'm just looking at so 1.7 of Prototype was released in November of 2010 and is now November 2012. And Prototype 1.7.1 came out in June of 2012. So there was a couple years there in between of zero development. it was probably good. There was probably some bugs that were worth fixing and stuff. Oh, look, it was Sam Stevenson was the original creator of it. Huh? I guess that's where it is on GitHub anyway. He's a 37 Signals dude, which makes sense because it came with Rails.
Rails, yeah.
So, yeah, it's nice that they probably fix some bugs and they'll probably just call it a day on this. Woofoo is actually using Prototype on a lot of stuff just because it was the cool kid on the block for a minute.
Dude.
And it's not a big deal. It's
plus
not,
Scriptaculous was the bee's knees.
All kinds of awesome. Yeah, yeah. And it's not like awful. There's not a big reason to go rewrite a lot of stuff unless there's some clear kind of benefit. Unless you're rewriting some stuff anyway, then you might as well switch. But just go in and strip out Prototype and put in jQuery. It's not a lot of bang for your buck there, really. I don't think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Don't change an architecture.
Don't pick Prototype now, for God's sakes.
Jeez. Yeah, don't pick it. If you need like something industrial, you could look at something like Dojo. You need something heavy duty or something like that, but. Or just use jQuery.
Yeah, you know what? I think the jQuery people largely consider jQuery kind of a wrap too. I think it's under more active development, but the community is a lot different around jQuery now than it was in its heyday. Mm-hmm. Back in the jQuery days, and how it was all exciting and is the thing. Now, JavaScript world has been like, okay, so you use jQuery, but that doesn't actually solve your site architecture problems. Now we're talking about different things now. Like how do you actually build a site, assuming jQuery as obviously jQuery,
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I
agree. I think jQuery is just, it's still good and you should still use it in my opinion, but it's just sitting around waiting for browsers to die or have huge bugs. And then it's going to fix those,
That's right.
So anyway, there you go. Next question.
Yeah, Richard. Is that what the one we're on?
Yeah, Richard.
Richard Bray. This is just a plug. We wouldn't do this normally all the time, but I just, I'll do it when I can. Feel free to send this stuff in anytime. Richard doesn't have a question. He just wanted to share a project that he put together. So go to richbray.me/CMS. Not content management system, but in this case, Color Me SAS. So he put together this color library for SAS and less. And at first I looked at it and I was kind of like, eh. Like he basically picked like 1,000 colors and gave them all a SAS variable name. So if you wanted to do this, you could just include this in your project and then you have variable names for like all kinds of different reds. And at first I was like, I can't memorize all these, so why don't I just use the hex code? It just seemed weird at first, but the more I looked at it, he uses the same exact naming convention through everything. So you aren't memorizing them, you're just memorizing the convention. So if you need to use yellow, you just use yellow because yellow is yellow. And then if you need a lighter version of yellow, it's just yellow light.
Yeah.
Or yellow dark, or yellow dull, or yellow bright. And that's the same thing for any other color, too. You'd just use orange, orange light, orange bright, whatever. And it has those. So you wouldn't memorize them. You would just kind of know in your brain that that's available to use. So kind of neat.
Yeah.
Thanks for sending that in, Richard. We can't feature every single project that people send in, but we can, especially when they're pretty cool.
Yeah, he's got, like, alternate colors for, like, Bootstrap and stuff like that. And, you know what? I think I have an idea that could make you tens of dollars. Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Tens of dollars. Pantone. Like if you had like red 5895 or something like that and it matched a Pantone exactly. So like when some fancy designer comes and is like, oh, that's Pantone 9259, I could be like, yeah, I got that.
It would probably be a mix-in at that point. Rather than trying to individually define every single variable, you would just write Pantone colon and then pass it the Pantone number.
Yeah, totally.
It would just spit out the thing. That's a good idea.
Hey, tens of dollars waiting for you.
Last question. Yeah. Just waiting. Taken.
Here we go. Yusef Mubin writes in and says, I am building my portfolio and I want to display some testimonials from clients. Ah, I love this. What is the best semantic way to style a block quote, especially if I want to display quotation marks? In the site tag, you can include other information after a name, for example, job title, or in the site, sorry, that has a question mark at the end. In the site tag, can you include other informations after the name, for example, a job title? I think this is totally possible. So,
well, you're displaying a quote, so it's for sure in a block quote.
Yeah.
Unless it's in line, which it probably isn't.
Yeah.
But if it's in line, what is it? Q, right?
Q.
Q. So it's probably not. It's probably a big, you know, big quote, like, you know, big thing. So it's probably block quote. And then block quote does, a site works with block quote. So if you want to say, like, well, if people wanted a faster horse or whatever, Henry Ford, you would put the block quote in. You would put the faster horse.
The best quote.
Then you would put cite Henry Ford. And I'm looking at the what WG for that. I think you could put the cite right in the block quote if you wanted to, because cite is a inline level element, so there's no problem with that. Although there is no attributes necessarily on cite that are specifically link the block quote and the cite, which I think it was weird. I think it almost deserves a for attribute.
I agree with that.
Yeah. So you could do cite for and then match it to the ID of the block quote or something, so there's some connection between them, but that's not the case apparently. I don't know. I don't know if there's a semantic perfect thing for a block quote and stuff. Can you use cite to put in a job title?
You could. You can do like a BR and then a job title if you wanted. I mean, you're just citing, you know, it doesn't, you don't have to like overthink that. But if you wanted it to be super clean in your HTML, you could have like a data job title attribute and data job title, you know, car maker. And then it just says Henry Ford in your site tag, and then do a site after content data or attribute job data job title. Did I say that right? That was confusing. Just to inject the job title if you wanted to. That would be a way to do it.
You know, in reading this spec right here, I feel like I misspoke in that it's pretty clear about what you should cite, and it's pretty clear that a person's name isn't to be cited.
Whoa.
Let's look here. A person's name is not a title of a work, even if people call that person a piece of work, and the element thus therefore not be used to mark up people's names.
Whoa.
In some cases, the B element might be appropriate for names, e.g. in a gossip article where the names of famous people are keywords rendered by a different style to draw attention to them. In other cases, which I would say it was more strong E, but whatever. In other cases, if an element is really needed, then a span element can be used. So it's saying an example of where cite should be used is, my favorite book is Cite, The Reality Dysfunction by Peter F. Hamilton, which Peter F. Hamilton is not in a cite tag or anything. It's just in the P tag. My favorite comic is Cite, Pearls Before Swine, End Cite by Stefan Bastis. Stefan, not in anything. So it's just saying, just don't use anything. And if you absolutely need to put somebody's, you know, who you're attributing that block quote to, just use a span, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy, though. That's new to me. I would use cite. I would immediately say cite is appropriate.
I most certainly would. And, that's interesting.
Maybe it's a blog post waiting to happen.
Yeah.
But you know what? The spec also adapts to how people use it. So if enough people were up in arms over this, they would change this. Mm-hmm. This isn't, you know, carved into stone. So maybe we could start an uproar about it. We could get really pissed.
Mm.
Opera. Yeah.
Opera. Hey, you know whose fault this is? Opera. Oh, geez. It's just, we're building the storm here. All right. Well, shoot. This
the only person I feel bad about is Mike Taylor, because he's such an awesome guy, and he works for Opera. So every time I say something rude about Opera, I'm like, oh, Mike, I hope you don't listen to this.
No, Mike, don't worry, Mike. We're talking about a different Opera, some other guy named Opera. Jeez. Yeah. Yeah, poor guy.
Isn't Bruce Lawson still Opera?
No. I love Opera. No, I love it. No. It's some other. Yeah. That was, I meant Firefox. All right. Speaking of fire. Hopefully that answers your question, Yusuf. I think it's a mystery, man. And I don't think. I don't think you can do wrong, really, in my opinion. But maybe just don't use cite. That might be a good then that'll solve all your problems. There you go. I don't know. I noticed on Bruce Lawson's post that he was putting them in a footer element. So there you go.
Fascinating.
A footer element inside a block.
Inside the block quote? Yeah. I like it.
That like sounds it. Good, too. That sounds... Mm-hmm. Let's do a final answer to that one. All right. Cool, Chris. I think we're done with
yep,
today's...
Yeah, that's all we got.
Let's kick that... Ooh.
I hope some of you listening are in Hawaii with us, and you'll listen to this when you get home. If not, enjoy your week of regular life or whatever, and we'll see you next week with a guest. I don't think I'm going to tell you, even though I have it scheduled. I feel like you never know, you know?
Yeah, well, it's going to if the guest comes through, it's going to be a good one, another good one. So.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. And always, you know, rate us up in iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. And that's the best way to get updates on whether, you know, shows or when they're going to be released, when we need you to ask questions, stuff like that. Follow us there. And, Chris, you got anything?
ShopTalkShow.com.